All right, so we are looking at Psalm number 37, and starting as we usually do with our summary statement of the psalm, Psalm 37 instructs the righteous to trust in the Lord and wait for His reward. I'll go over that one more time. Psalm 37 instructs the righteous to trust in the Lord and wait for His reward. All right, simple outline for this psalm actually breaks it into four parts. So we have verses 1 to 11, instruction. Verses 12 to 20, meditation. Verses 21 to 29, two ways. Verses 30 to 40, call to wait and trust. And I'll go over that again. So the outline for the psalm, verses 1 to 11, instruction. Verses 12 to 20, meditation. Verses 21 to 29, two ways. Verses 30 to 40, call to wait and trust. All right, so let's go to our observations for Psalm 37. It was written by David, as you can see in the superscription, a psalm of David. So it is ascribed to him. There's no occasion for the psalm that is mentioned. There's also no musical direction that's given in the heading of the psalm or in the text of the psalm. Psalm 37 is what we would categorize as a wisdom or Torah psalm. It is a psalm of instruction. A number of things make that clear in this psalm. For instance, the psalm is not addressed to God, but it is addressed to people. Typically, a psalm that's a prayer or a praise or a lament is addressed toward God. But that is not the case here. It is actually addressed to people. So David here is the sage king, and a sage is just a wisdom teacher, and he's giving instruction in wisdom. Now the psalm focuses on the righteous and the wicked, which is a very common wisdom theme, contrasts the ways of each, their actions, their doings, and also contrasts their long-term destiny. So we see their doings and their maybe their situation in the short term contrasted with their long-term destinies. This, as a wisdom psalm, it also considers time in the present and into the future. When you study wisdom literature, like in the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, there's just a long view of wisdom, and time is considered not only in this instant moment, but also in the future and that is to come. And that is the long view of wisdom in this psalm as well. Has a number of other wisdom features, we would say, that it's mostly in a two-line proverb format. Proverbs, when we talk about Proverbs in particular, in the book of Proverbs, we think of that two-line format, and most of these are in that format. It teaches with a few different methods of wisdom, gives prohibitions. In other words, gives things, you know, don't do this, don't go this way, what have you. It gives imperatives, which are in positive commands, things that you must do, and then also at times presents contrasts. And presenting of contrasts is a way of wisdom teaching that is essentially like presenting us with choices. Like, here is the way of the wicked on one hand and their end, and here is the way of the righteous on this hand and their end. It also uses a very common proverb formula, which is that of the better than. And you see that particularly in verse number 16. But it's a formula that's very common in the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes particular. Better is this, better is the righteous than the wicked, and usually some situation of each is contrasted there. So it certainly is a wisdom psalm. Now, Psalm 37 shares a concern about the wicked with the psalms that come before it, like Psalm 35 and Psalm 36. So there's definitely a connection there, but it is most closely connected actually to Psalm 1 and Psalm 2. And obviously that's no surprise. As soon as we categorize the main elements of, or the main category or genre of a psalm as being wisdom, then we should think of Psalm 1 and 2. But so in Psalm 1, you have a contrast of the two ways, which is in this psalm as well. You have a reward for the righteous and judgment for the wicked. You have the imagery of withering. Now in Psalm 1, in verse number 3, it's the righteous whose leaf shall not wither. And here in Psalm 37, it's the wicked who shall wither. They shall not last. We have God's knowledge of the righteous. He knows the way of the righteous. We have that here as well as in Psalm 1. And we also have the meditation on God's law here in verses 30 and 31, as well as in Psalm 1 and verse number 2. So there's a number of connections with Psalm number 1, but also with Psalm number 2. So Psalm number 2 speaks of the constant plotting of the wicked in the very beginning of that psalm. And we have the same here, for instance, like in verse number 12 of this psalm. We have God laughing at the plotting and raging of the wicked in Psalm 2, verse 4, as well as in verse 13 here. We also have the imminence of judgment that is important to Psalm 2, particularly toward the end of Psalm 2, verses 8 to 12. In other words, when the wicked of the earth that are plotting and imagining vain things against the Lord and His anointed, they're given a warning there, and that warning is based on the fact that you had better now kiss the Son, which is the terms there. You better now submit, lest He be angry. In other words, the indication being that time is running out. Time is not infinite for them. And so the same element is in this psalm, particularly in verses 2, 10, and 13. Also, the taking of refuge in God. Both psalms end using that word for trust in Psalm 2:12 and here in verse number 40. And there are also a few other connections between those two psalms as well. So the poetic features of Psalm 37. Psalm 37, obviously the main feature of its structure is that it is an acrostic psalm. So it does proceed in alphabet order, where the first word in the Hebrew begins with the successive letters of the alphabet. And usually it's in groups of twos, though it's not always in groups of twos in this particular psalm, but it is mostly in groups of twos. You'll have two verses that start with, Aleph, and then going to two verses with Beit and whatever, going through the alphabet that way. And one of the things that happens when you have that kind of structure, the acrostic structure, is that when you just read this psalm, and especially reading it in an English translation, we're not immediately aware that it has that kind of a structure. But when you read this psalm, it can seem like the psalm sort of wanders around, and that it jumps from topic to topic and then kind of circles back to some. It can seem to be a little bit meandering, but that is because the structure is imposed by the acrostic that was used. And also it being a wisdom psalm, it's not written to develop a theme or argument like, say, the book of Romans that we've been studying, where everything is linked and building upon one another to this point or that point or what have you. And that's not the way that this psalm works. Poetically, it does use some repetition. The name of Yahweh, I think, maybe 17 times in this psalm. Words like fret, which occurs a few times. The land, the inheritance, occurs numerous times in the psalm. You also do have some imagery, not extravagant imagery, but particularly like that of the grass, herbs, and trees, and mainly here comparing the wicked to them that, flower for a little while and then are gone. You have the wicked presented as hunters, maybe even a military imagery there. and also presented as wild beasts on the other hand. We also have the imagery of the sun and the light of the sun. All right, so we want to walk through this psalm, 40 verses, so it's one of the longer psalms. And obviously, as we go through, we're not going to be able to go into a lot of detail in the particular verses, even dealing with the theology of the psalm and what have you. We're not going to be able to go into a lot of detail, but we want. But what we try to do in these psalms is that we want to focus on the unique contribution that this psalm is making. I mean, we do want to pay attention to how it ties together with other psalms and such, but we want to look at the unique contribution to the biblical theology of the psalms in general and of the Bible as a whole. So anyway, all that's just to say that we're not going to be able to go into great detail. But I do want to go ahead and read this psalm, and then we'll sort of look at it in a few different chunks. Fret not thyself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against the workers of iniquity. For they shall soon be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. So shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. Delight thyself also in the Lord, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart. Commit thy way unto the Lord. Trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. And he shall bring forth thy righteousness as the light, and thy judgment as the noonday. Rest in the Lord, and wait patiently for him. Fret not thyself because of him who prospereth in his way, because of the man who bringeth wicked devices to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not thyself in any wise to do evil. For evildoers shall be cut off, but those that wait upon the Lord, they shall inherit the earth. For yet a little while, and the wicked shall not be. Yea, thou shalt diligently consider his place, and it shall not be. But the meek shall inherit the earth, and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. The wicked plotteth against the just, and gnasheth upon him with his teeth. The Lord shall laugh at him, for he seeth that his day is coming. The wicked have drawn out the sword and have bent their bow to cast down the poor and needy, and to slay such as be of upright conversation. Their sword shall enter into their own heart, and their bows shall be broken. A little that a righteous man hath is better than the riches of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but the Lord upholdeth the righteous. The Lord knoweth the days of the upright, and the inheritance shall be forever. They shall not be ashamed in the evil time, and in the days of famine they shall be satisfied. But the wicked shall perish, and the enemies of the Lord shall be as the fat of lambs. They shall consume into smoke, shall they consume away. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous showeth mercy and giveth. For such as be blessed of him shall inherit the earth, and they that be cursed of him shall be cut off. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delighteth in his way. Though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholdeth him with his hand. I have been young, and now am old, yet have I not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. He is ever merciful and lendeth, and his seed is blessed. Depart from evil and do good, and dwell forevermore. For the Lord loveth judgment, and forsaketh not his saints. They are preserved forever, but the seed of the wicked shall be cut off. The righteous shall inherit the land and dwell therein forever. The mouth of the righteous speaketh wisdom, and his tongue talketh of judgment. The law of his God is in his heart. None of his steps shall slide. The wicked watcheth the righteous and seeketh to slay him. The Lord will not leave him in his hand, nor condemn him when he is judged. Wait on the Lord and keep his way, and he shall exalt thee to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, thou shalt see it. I have seen the wicked in great power and spreading himself like a green bay tree. Yet he passed away, and lo, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found. Mark the perfect man and behold the upright, for the end of that man is peace. But the transgressor shall be destroyed together. The end of the wicked shall be cut off. But the salvation of the righteous is of the Lord. He is their strength in the time of trouble. And the Lord shall help them and deliver them. And he shall deliver them from the wicked and save them because they trust in him. So verses 1 to 11 open this psalm with instruction. David is instructing the righteous not to fret, not to be angry, not to have wrath. And he is saying this in terms of the wicked. The terms that he uses for fret and angry and wrath, I mean, they're all related terms. And they picture a person becoming heated up And that's actually what the word for fret means, to be heated up. They picture a person becoming heated up because the wicked in the world seem to prosper in their wicked ways. And so he is giving instruction here not to become enraged. Don't become angered. Don't be fretting over the wicked. And he instructs here in these verses to avoid the temptation to be jealous of the wicked. And this enviousness or this jealousy of the wicked is because of their gain. In other words, don't be jealous of the gains that the wicked have made because they don't have to play by the rules. So in other words, whether it's out of anger or out of jealousy, we are being warned and instructed that we are not to do evil in response to the exasperating success of the wicked. And we've all experienced this. Sometimes it can be very personal. In other words, sometimes it can be very close to home. It can be someone who has maybe afflicted us or has caused us problems, and then we see them succeed in life, and it can make us angry, or it can make us jealous. You know, why did this guy at the office get the promotion? You know, why did this woman get this new car? Why, they're a terrible person, and they're causing me problems for no good reason. And you know, why did they come into this success? You know, they lied and cheated and stealed and or stole or whatever. So he's saying that out of anger or out of jealousy, we can do evil in response to the success of the wicked. And that's what he's instructing us here not to do. Now, one of the reasons that he gives for not doing this in this section of verses and really in this whole psalm is that the successes of the wicked are only temporary. Doesn't matter how big they may seem to be in the moment. Doesn't matter how much applause that they may receive from the world or recognition. The wicked, they may lie and cheat and steal their way to gain fame, to gain fortune, to gain power, but it will not last forever. So you can certainly see this wisdom perspective that is coming in. Live your life wisely. Have, as Ecclesiastes put it, have eyes in your head. Look out upon what's going on. And just because the wicked have risen to power, fame, and fortune, and what have you, and they've done all sorts of illegal things to get there. They've done all sorts of unethical things to get there. They've done all sorts of sinful things to get there. No, first of all, David is saying that it will not last forever. And their undoing, he tells us in this section of verses, it will be soon in verse 2. It will be in a little while in verse number 10. In other words, he's pointing to the fact that, yes, their success is temporary, but there's also a future and a final judgment that is waiting them in the future. The wicked will be, as he says in verse 2, cut down and withered. In verse 9, they will be cut off. And in verse 10, they will be removed. And all of those terms are terms that are associated with condemnation. I mean, they're associated with death, but it's not just death in terms of physical death, but it's the damnation of death. It is condemnation. So there is a judgment. No matter what successes they may enjoy, what riches, what prosperity, what abundance, whatever it is that they may achieve in this life, and no matter how many, you know, who they may have hurt to do so, and even if they have hurt you or me, it's only temporary, and there is a judgment that is coming. So then on the other hand, he also tells us in this section of verses what the righteous should do. So those who trust in the Lord, those who are living by faith, seeking to live in the way of wisdom, what should we do? Well, rather than fretting, rather than being enraged and angered, the righteous are instructed to trust in the Lord and to do good in verse number 3. So in other words, don't, like he's going to say in verse number 8 essentially, don't return evil for evil. Just because the wicked are doing evil and they're getting away with it and they're being rewarded, it seems, don't go down that road. You trust in the Lord and do good. Delight in the Lord in verse 4. Commit yourself to the Lord and trust in Him, verse 5. Rest and wait on the Lord in verse number 7. And he describes the rewards for the righteous being fed in verse 3, desires fulfilled in verse 4, their way established in verse 5, ultimately inheriting the earth, verses 9 and 11, and delighting in that abundance of peace. So don't become enraged or jealous of the wicked so that you would go in the way of evil like they have. Know that their situation is temporary, however good it may seem, and that their final judgment is coming, and also being instructed to wait. All right, then we come to verses 12 to 20. Verses 12 to 20 make wisdom observations about the wicked and the righteous. The wicked particularly are shown to be plotting against the righteous. In other words, the wicked and the enemies in this psalm are those that are actually actively working against those who trust in the Lord, seeking their downfall. They're not just willing to step on whoever, you know, in order to get what they want, but they're also actively working for the downfall of the righteous. He says they are plotting against the just and the upright in verse 12, plotting against the poor and needy in verse 14. And one thing about the poor and needy, as we've already seen a number of times in the Psalms that we've covered up to this point, is that this is another term that is associated with those who are in covenant with the Lord. In other words, it's the poor and needy who trust in the Lord, seen as poor and needy in terms of the world. He says that they are seeking to cast down and to slay in verse number 14. They're described as using all of the weapons at their disposal. So they plot against and they gnash against the righteous in verse 12. They're using the sword and the bow in verse 14, using their arms, obviously, in verse number 17. Well, then he also considers the fate of the wicked. They may afflict the righteous, but they will not ultimately succeed. Their judgment is coming. We see that again in verse number 13. Their weapons shall be their own destruction in verse number 14, which is another common wisdom element. The arms that they gather riches with, the arms that they afflict the righteous with, will be broken in verse 17. In other words, they will not be able to hold. They won't be able to retain what it is that they have gathered. The wicked are described as the enemies of the Lord, and they will perish, and they will be burnt up in smoke in verse number 20. So with all that against the righteous in these observations, he also observes that the Lord is for the righteous. So yes, the righteous have many that are against them, but the Lord is for them. And we have in verse 17 that proverbial better than statement. A little that a righteous man hath is better than the riches of many wicked. And that and there's actually a number of Proverbs verses that say essentially the same thing. So comparing less material wealth and success, but more blessing for the righteous. The righteous are upheld by God in verse number 17. In other words, they may have many stumbles and trips and falls in this life, but the righteous will never be utterly cast down. In other words, they won't come to the ruin that the wicked come to in judgment because they're upheld by God. Even talks about them holding their hand later on. They have their future inheritance preserved forever in verse number 18. It's safe. You know, Jesus talked about in Matthew chapter number 6, the laying up a treasure in heaven. And what did he say about it? He said, the moth and the rust don't corrupt it, and thieves cannot break through and steal. This inheritance is preserved. It's something the wicked cannot get to. They can't reach. They can't take it away. He also says that they will not be ashamed and they will be satisfied in verse 19. In other words, no matter what all the circumstances of the present life may be, they will come to the point where they will be righteous in judgment and they will be satisfied with abundance forevermore. So the next set of verses in verses 21 to 29, David is here contrasting the ways of the righteous and the wicked. And there's an obvious implication whenever we have in wisdom literature a contrast between the ways of the righteous and the wicked. The obvious implication is that you choose the way of righteousness. You choose the way of wisdom. The righteous are merciful and generous, he tells us in verses 21 and 26. They're generous and they are upheld. They're supported by God. They are kept up by God, verse 24. And they will dwell forever, not be forsaken, be preserved, and ultimately inherit the earth or the land, verses 27 to 29. Now, the contrast comes with the wicked. In verse 21, they borrow and don't pay back. In other words, they steal. The wicked, when you look at the law, for instance, and the law would talk about not lending to the poor with usury, you know, not charging interest to the poor. And if you had lended to or loaned to your brother in need and he had given his cloak as a pledge, you were to return that by sundown because that was his only covering and protection against the cold. In other words, when the law talks about lending and giving, it has a love your neighbor approach to it. Well, the wicked, we can see, they borrow and don't pay again. They have no intention of paying again. They're just trying to get what they want and get what they need. They don't care about you. They don't care about the fact that you may need your cloak that you've loaned to them, or you may need the money that you have, you know, that they have borrowed from you and promised to repay. The seed of the righteous is blessed and provided for in verses 25 and 26, but the seed of the wicked will be cut off in verse number 28. And then we come to verses 30 to 40. And this group of verses closes the psalm, and really we see here a lot of circling back to some of the earlier themes from the psalm. And these verses call on the righteous to wait on the Lord. Imperative or that command is reinforced in this part of the psalm. Now, the way of the righteous in verses 30 and 31 echoes that of Psalm number 1, having the law in their heart, speaking of it. The mouth of the righteous speaketh wisdom. The word there is the same word used for meditate in Psalm 1. Now, he says they have the law of God in his heart. And one of the interesting things about law, the word law as it is used, it can mean the old covenant law. It can mean specifically that old covenant law. It can also mean the books of Moses, as in distinct from the prophets or the writings. But it can also mean the whole word of God. And in fact, it's interesting to note that Jesus referred to the Psalms and called them law in John chapter 10, verse 34, John 15, 5. So here, this having the law of God in his heart and meditating on it, I believe is the whole word of God, is not just talking about the old covenant law or just the books of Moses, but the whole word of God. And though the wicked threaten and assail the righteous, God will not leave the fate of the righteous in the hands of the wicked. We see this in verses 32 and 33. The wicked oftentimes look like a great tree in the present, spreading themselves out, having all of this beautiful foliage, but it will not last. You know, we're currently in fall. We're heading toward winter. The leaves that have been on the trees and you know, they went from green and they began turning to their colors, and there's a beauty in that, but boy, that beauty lasts for such a short amount of time. And then they start falling, and they've really been falling here lately, and pretty soon there won't be a leaf on anything, and everything will just look dead and brown and ugly. Of course, we know that it's coming back in the spring. But the wicked are being compared to that. A great tree, it can look great and mighty for a little while, but it will not last. It'll die out. In fact, verses 35 to 36 say that such that it can't be found in the land. So there's a call in verses 37 to 38 to discern the righteous and distinguish them from the wicked, but recognizing the difference in their fates. And it's a very proverbial type of statement, like mark the perfect man. You know, that man will succeed. You know, see a wise man, you know, see a man that's conscientious, you know, he will prosper and so on. Then we have the rescue and the deliverance of the righteous in verses 39 to 40. And in those verses, you can see that it is all of the Lord. He is their strength. He is their help. He's their deliverer. He is their salvation. And the psalm ends that the righteous have taken refuge in Him. All right, so let's move to interpretations. What does Psalm 37 teach? Well, again, we're going to focus on a few things. Psalm 37 teaches the faithful how to live in this present world. Now, this is particularly in light of the apparent success of the wicked. And again, that can be the wicked that are far off. In other words, maybe those who aren't necessarily affecting us directly, like they're not our next door neighbor, but those who are using all sorts of unlawful means to achieve wealth and power and what have you. So in light of the apparent success of the wicked, the overwhelming message of this psalm is do not be angry. Do not be enraged because of the prosperity of the wicked. Don't be jealous of their success. Don't envy them what they have, that they have got through whatever means. And there's a very strong warning in this psalm that we be careful that we're not returning evil for evil. So we can become angry with the success of the wicked to the point that we sin. And that could happen in a number of ways. We can become angry with the wicked to the point that we're jealous of them. One way that we could do this is by just becoming exasperated to the point that we just want to throw in the towel, so to speak. Like, they have gotten ahead through all of these means. I'm trying to live in a way that's right and honors God, and I seem to always be coming up on the short end of the stick. Just forget it all. We're just going to toss it all to the side, and I'm just going to go the way of the wicked. That is a terrible danger and temptation that is in front of us. And this psalm is very strongly warning us not to succumb to that sort of angry and jealous thinking. It will lead us into evil and ultimately leads to destruction. So this psalm is instructing us to calm down. And when you look at the words that the psalm uses, it talks about fretting, anger, wrath, jealousy. And then it counters that with words like trust, wait patiently, delight, be still or be quiet, and hope. Calm down. Obviously, we should be more informed by the Word of God rather than being apprised of the latest schemes of the wicked. And I would say that's another danger that we face. When the wicked seem to prosper, we are in danger of becoming obsessed with their prosperity, becoming obsessed with their illegalities, becoming obsessed with their wicked ways. But obviously here, the righteous man is trusting in the Lord, is doing good, and has God's law in his heart. He's more informed by the Word of God than he is the news media or any other various outlets and means of worldly information. The psalm does not deny the afflictions of the righteous by the wicked. I mean, obviously, this psalm takes that into account. But overall, this psalm is urging us to commit ourselves to God and to endure suffering like Jesus that Peter mentions in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 23. Also, Psalm 37 teaches a wisdom worldview. The psalm is not naive, but rather has a robust grasp of reality that is like the books of Job and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. And there are actually many parallels with those books and this particular psalm. But unlike Job, this psalm is not wrestling with the question of why the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer. Now, there are some psalms that do that. This psalm is just not one of those. It's not wrestling with that question of why the righteous suffer. I mean, this psalm just accepts that as a fact. That is the situation of the world. Now, the wisdom worldview then sees the creation as ordered in a certain way because the wisdom of the Creator and fully accounts for the effects of sin on the world. So the creation order, in other words, understanding the creation order, that it leads generally to success for adhering to the right way and failure for going contrary to the right way. One of the things that this teaches us is that the land or the earth or the creation is not autonomous, but it's governed. It's not Mother Nature just throwing whatever whims at us that it wants to. No, this is a governed and an ordered creation. And there are ways that we should go and ways we should not go. And there are consequences and rewards for each. So what this means is that the worldview of wisdom has a belief in God's providence rather than the wicked's prosperity. In other words, the prosperity of the wicked, you understand it to be temporary. And you're not tempted to say, you know what, I've tried God's way, I've tried the Bible way, I've tried the right way, and it hasn't worked. Obviously, what they're doing is working, and so I'm going to go that way. Well, a wisdom worldview has an understanding of God's providence and understands that oftentimes the very things that the wicked are achieving and accomplishing and receiving are also the very things that are going to be their undoing in God's justice. So the wisdom conclusion then, like in the book of Ecclesiastes or in the book of Proverbs, is very same as this psalm. It's better to have wisdom, even if you have only little in this life and you find the life to come, than it is to have a lot in this life and find death to come. All right, so that brings us to the messianic hope of this psalm. Now, this psalm is full of covenantal references, and obviously covenantal references point ultimately to messianic hope because of messianic fulfillment necessary for those. But again, we're just going to focus on the more unique messianic hope to this particular psalm. So it is a wisdom psalm, and so that means that David is the anointed king sage giving wisdom instruction, and furthermore, he instructs from his own experience. That's actually one of the characteristic marks or features of wisdom instruction is that the wisdom teacher teaches also from their own experience. You see that in the case of Solomon in Ecclesiastes and in Proverbs both. And you see that here in the Psalms as well. In this, David is prefiguring the greater than Solomon anointed king sage Jesus, who was and is the teacher of wisdom par excellence. Jesus, his own self, walked the road or the way of the righteous. He was plotted against. He was even put to death by the wicked. But that wasn't his end. And his destiny was not determined by his enemies and by the haters of righteousness, but rather he was raised up in life. Now, a major theme in this psalm that we haven't really said much about to this point is actually the land inheritance. This is mentioned in verses 3, 9, 11, 18, 22, 27, 29, and 34. It's a very major theme in this particular psalm. The righteous, we are told, are preserved to it. That inheritance is preserved for them, and they're preserved to it so that they come into that inheritance and they will possess it forever. The wicked, on the other hand, they're cut off from it. They shall not be remembered in it. They'll have no posterity there. Now, the same word for land or earth that's used in this psalm in a number of places is also used in Psalm 2 in verses 2, 8, and 10. Kings of the earth in verse 2. The earth as the inheritance of the anointed son king in verse 8. And those judges of the earth in verse 10. It is identified as the place of the king's inheritance, of the anointed son king of God. It is his inheritance, this earth, Psalm 2, verse 8, where the kings, the judges of the earth, have a short time if they do not submit to the son, according to verses 2 and 10. So the possession of this inheritance and the meeting out of judgment, which means the cutting off of the wicked, is connected with the coming of the Son. In other words, this inheritance, it is His kingdom. That is the inheritance of the saints. Now, also the promise to be exalted in verse number 34, wait on the Lord and keep His way, and He shall exalt thee to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, thou shalt see it. Now, that word for exalt is the same word that appears in several other messianic psalms and is referred to the lifting up that has to do with the exaltation of the Messiah. So Psalm 3 and verse 3, Psalm 9 and verse 13, Psalm 18 and verse 48, Psalm 27 verses 5 and 6. These all have to do with the Messiah being exalted to His position, to His inheritance. And here the promise comes to the righteous that you will be exalted to the inheritance. So the hope of the righteous, it is the messianic hope. It is the Messiah who secures the rewards for the righteous and is their salvation, those who have taken refuge in God. All right, application. I have 2 points of application for modern readers. Number one, Psalm 37 helps us understand our relationship to the sinful world and even those who may be afflicting and opposing us and hurting us in various ways. We're not to be driven by anger or jealousy toward the ungodly. We must be careful unless we become exasperated and give in to the ways of the wicked. One of the things that Ecclesiastes talks about is how it is much more difficult to build something up than it is to tear it down. And even someone who is known for wisdom can have a horrific moment of folly. And that's the sort of thing that we can be tempted to when we become too fixated on the wicked. Now, I don't say that to say that we should not pursue justice on the earth and all that sort of thing. Yes, we should. But what the psalm is telling us is that we should not be driven by anger or jealousy to where we are going in the ways of the wicked because they seem to work. Number two, Psalm 37 helps us understand that our primary reward is not here and now. There, you know, you might isolate a statement here or there out of this psalm and make it sound like a prosperity gospel, but obviously that doesn't work. You can't isolate. You have to. It is wisdom literature. It is a psalm. You have to take it all together, and there is a whole worldview that is given there. So our reward is not here and now, and we're never told to be seeking that reward here and now. Although we experience untold blessings from God, but we're not seeking that now. We have an inheritance that is preserved for us. And that inheritance far surpasses any momentary earthly success that we could experience.